You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 7th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, chicken. Yeah, I said it, chicken. Well, actually, chicken farming. Well, actually, a great story. Well, not necessarily. It doesn't end too well. But on how the Obama administration tried to return some balance to the farming industry and ultimately was shot down by corporate money. We'll be talking to Lena Khan. She is the policy analyst for Markets, Enterprise, and Resiliency Initiative at the New America Foundation. Also on the program today, filibuster reform. Not so much. I mean, it's here, but it's not really here. More news on Walmart. I guess the upside is, it's not just Americans they're screwing. New York Police Department apparently has a lot of interesting phone records that they shouldn't have. The Grand Bargain Watch continues. David Plouffe sending us signals from the White House. Senator Durbin sending other signals from the Senate. And file this one in, you already knew it, but more and more evidence coming out. The Republican Party has essentially one policy initiative. It is to keep people from voting. So on that Grand Bargain Watch, just briefly, David Plouffe, I don't know where he was being interviewed. Some think tank.
It was a forum at the University of Delaware, which is where he went to school.
Oh, well, good for him. And he basically said, warned people of paralysis, expressed some type of fantastical notion that if we got our fiscal house in order, whatever the heck that means, when you have a recession, whatever it means to have, it's essentially like your house has been flooded, but if we can make sure that we've dusted everything, our economy will soar over the next 20 years. And he warned of paralysis if both parties remain beholden to their base, saying that Obama's looking for a deal. That, quote, the only way to get this done is for Republicans again to step back and get mercilessly criticized by Grover Norquist and the right. And it means that Democrats are going to have to do some tough things on spending and entitlements. That means they'll be criticized on by their left. I wonder what Pete Peterson or banking industry David Plouffe will end up in. But meanwhile, Dick Durbin said that progressives should be willing to talk about ways to ensure the long-term viability of Medicare and Medicaid, but those conversations should not be part of a plan to avert the fiscal cliff. He's basically also saying Social Security off the table. And that is a change for Durbin. As far as I can tell, he had at least signaled that he was on board with the Simpson-Bowles letter written by those two old coots to President Obama, suggesting that Social Security be trimmed, not slashed, just trimmed, you know. You know those folks making that 12 big bucks, that 1,200 bucks a month in their retirement, living large? Maybe we trim their sales a little bit. Yeah, you cut short that trip to the Bahamas or whatever it is. Do people even go to the Bahamas anymore? They must, right? So that's where we are today. There's a lot of talk about essentially a punt coming up with $80 billion worth of new revenue, $80 billion worth of cuts, and basically punting a lot of the things like the sequester and perhaps some tax expenditures that were going to be closed down the road. Who knows? There's a lot of high-level talks going on that we are not privy to. We only see their reflection, like the shadows on the wall in that cave that Nietzsche talked about. Who was it that was talking about the...
Plato.
Well, Plato, whatever. Now, there was another story. It went further, though, about the shadows and the walls of the cave. It doesn't matter, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, this great story, it's a very interesting story to me. The untold story of how the administration's tried to stand up to big agricultural companies on behalf of independent farmers and lost by Lena Khan. We'll be right back after this, and we'll speak to her about it. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Lena Khan. She is a policy analyst for the Markets, Enterprise, and Resiliency Initiative at the New America Foundation. Welcome to the program, Lena.
Thank you.
So I really enjoyed your piece, which I think it's in, I printed out Washington Monthly. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
In the November-December issue of Washington Monthly, the untold story of how the administration tried to stand up to big agricultural companies on behalf of independent farmers and lost. So let's start with this story goes back to early, 2010. But even before then, where the Obama administration seemed to be making a very conservative and sincere effort to delve into this problem that, well, I don't know if we should call them independent farmers on some level because that's an issue. But just tell us what was going on. Who was looking into what at that time?
So exactly in 2010, and actually even earlier in 2009, once the Obama administration came in, they basically initiated far-reaching efforts to address how big agriculture companies abuse their power in the marketplace. So you had these efforts occurring on multiple levels. You had Christine Varney, who was antitrust chief at the DOJ at that point. She initiated these hearings, these national hearings around the country to basically give farmers a chance to come describe what they face in the marketplace. So these were hearings that, you know, were headed by Attorney General Holder and Agriculture Secretary Vilsack. So this is the top brass of the administration, and it really signaled that they were really serious about tackling some of the abuses that we now see in the marketplace.
So tell us what it is that that would interest the antitrust folks when it comes to farming of livestock, in particular, I guess, chicken, but it has application in other types of livestock.
Yeah, so basically our agriculture markets are now shaped like an hourglass. So on one hand, you have thousands of farmers, and on the other, you have millions of consumers. But in the middle, you have these handful of companies who process and package the meat. And because there are now so few of these companies, they're able to wield their power in a way that really doesn't offer farmers a fair shot at competing in the marketplace. And this is an antitrust issue because, you know, anytime you have immense consolidation of power and that power is being abused, it's something that DOJ is supposed to look into. And this has been going on for decades, you know, for the last couple of decades. And administration after administration has kind of ignored the issue or in many cases actually made it worse. So for farmers and ranchers, this was really momentous. I mean, you had, you know, the highest level officials in the administration finally listening to them. And as you said, it really seemed like it was a sincere effort on their part.
So, okay. So we had a problem in this country in the late 1800s, early 1900s, where we had five essentially big meatpacking companies. What were the laws that were passed at that time to deal with the problem of this antitrust problem that where you had these five companies that were essentially controlling the meatpacking market?
So that was around the time in 1890s when we first had our antitrust laws passed, and then you had – that was the Sherman Antitrust Act. And then in 1914, you had the Clayton Act. And these two laws basically were passed so that big companies wouldn't be able to abuse their power in marketplaces and kind of make them uncompetitive. In addition to that, you had in 1921 the Packers and Stockyards Act passed. And this was passed in response to the immense control that these five big meatpacking companies had wrested and were basically, you know, depriving farmers of a fair shot. So the Wilson administration in 1918 undertook this far-reaching investigation, the FTC at that time, and found that because these few companies had wrested so much control, farmers really didn't have a fair shot. And in response to that, they used antitrust law to require these companies to divest out of certain industries, and it really scaled back their power in a really remarkable way. So, you know, in 1918, you had the five largest meatpacking companies control 55% of the market. And by 1976, you know, by this point, a lot of those laws had been used to decentralize the market again, and the four largest companies controlled only 25% of it. So you really see how when these laws were still in effect, they really gave rise to, you know, a decentralized distributed marketplace that gave independent farmers a fair chance to compete.
And so so for quite a while, this was effective. And then in sometime in the 1950s, the marketplace changed again, where we saw that where in 1950, in the chicken business, I guess, the vast majority of farmers were selling their product into a traditional open market. By the end of that decade, they were working under selling essentially these chickens on contract. Explain to us what the difference is.
So, as you said, originally, you know, chicken farmers would raise their chickens and, you know, buy all their inputs, the feed and everything directly, raise the chickens, and then take them to market and sell directly. You know, there were a lot of changes in the industry, and it basically encouraged companies to adopt a contracting model, which basically means that there's a company that gives farmers the eggs and the birds and the inputs, and the farmers are essentially kind of renting the birds and raising them, and at the end of the contract cycle, the company takes them back. So it's, in the industry, this is called vertical integration, and it basically means that the farmers are doing all the work, and the companies, but at the end of the day, still own everything. And when this was first introduced, you know, there were a lot of benefits. So the contracting model in itself wasn't the issue. What really became the issue is when in 1980s you started seeing a lot of consolidation, and so you just had fewer and fewer companies, and that's kind of what a lot of the abuse stems from.
So we basically had a situation back in the 50s when this contracting model came in, where if a farmer, for whatever reason, didn't like the terms of the contract, the work that he was doing with the processor, or didn't like what feed they were suggesting he use, or they didn't any other aspects of dealing with them, they always had the ability to go to a different processor, and so there was a certain amount of competition. And then, as you say, this starts to change in the early 1980s, and that was a function of the Reagan administration and their new approach to antitrust laws.
Yeah, exactly. So in the early 80s, we saw the Reagan administration come in and basically rewrite the antitrust framework. So initially, antitrust laws were used to protect citizens against concentrated economic power. You know, so as I mentioned earlier, you know, the Wilson administration would see a handful of meatpackers wielding enormous control, and they would kind of use antitrust laws to investigate that power and, if necessary, to break it up. What the Reagan administration did is change the framework so that the goal was no longer, you know, fair markets. It was low prices. In the name of efficiency and kind of consumer welfare, the goal suddenly became to just for companies to be able to deliver goods as cheaply as possible. And if companies could, you know, prove or you know, claim that that's what they were doing, then everything else would kind of take a backseat to that. And as a result, that new framework kind of unleashed mergers through the 1980s and beyond, and has given rise to very consolidated industries, you know, in agriculture as well as other ones.
So by the end of that decade, we are now back from where at the beginning of that decade, you had meatpacking companies. The four biggest meatpacking companies controlled about 35% of the market. By the end of that decade, it had more than doubled at that point to about 72%. So that was really when we saw this change here. And as you're describing it, and if I understand it, the antitrust laws were no longer seen in a broader sense to protect everyone involved in that process, but rather it was just measured against, is there some type of price? Is it allowing for a some type of equilibrium in price as opposed to just sort of price fixing? Is that it?
Yeah, it's basically if companies can, you know, assert that a certain merger or a certain kind of business practice is leading to lower prices for consumers, that in and of itself, more often than not, DOJ equates with competition. So, you know, the main way that competition is measured now is low prices. And oftentimes, you know, it's very murky to be able to show whether prices are going up or down. And maybe more importantly, like, it totally overlooks a whole other host of issues, like in this case when, you know, lower down in the supply chain, independent farmers are being, you know, totally bullied and pushed around by these companies.
And then you talk about equally problematic, if not more so, in terms of for the farmers involved in this, is that the Packers and Stockyards Act had not only been weakened over time, but that the George W. Bush administration more or less stopped enforcement of the act altogether. What were the implications of that?
So, yeah, the Packers and Stockyards Act was, you know, a law that they said earlier was passed in 1920, and it was basically broadly prohibited unfair and discriminatory practices in the industry. And because it was written so in language that's quite broad, and it was written so long ago, over the years, enforcement has really been scaled back, with the, you know, Bush administration almost halting it entirely. And as a result, you know, companies are able to deceive farmers, to, you know, give them less than the market price worth of their goods. And this is all conduct that we saw earlier, in the earlier 1900s, and is why this act was passed. But because of narrow interpretation, a lot of the abuse that it was intended to prohibit now occurs rampantly.
Okay, so that takes us up to basically what happened in the beginning of the Obama administration. The Department of Justice is going on this tour to talk to farmers. What are they finding out that these farmers are experiencing?
So there are a whole host of issues. I mean, in the piece, I profile poultry farmers because that's where we see some of the worst of the abuse. So in poultry, oftentimes, because there are so few companies, these companies can dictate all of the terms of the transaction. So oftentimes, they'll require that a farmer make mandatory equipment upgrades, new chicken houses, you know, new ventilation systems, new cooling fans. And this often requires that the farmer take on substantial amount of debt, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions even. And the farmers will go ahead and do this. The company specifies everything about, you know, these upgrades, from the dimensions of the houses to the brand of the ventilation system. And so the farmer is in a very vulnerable position because now he's in a lot of debt, and yet he doesn't have many options for where to take his business. So this gives companies immense amount of control. And as a result, companies can essentially, you know, just drop the farmer with no notice, you know, just decide, oh, we're going to suspend the delivery of birds this week. You know, if farmers try to negotiate terms, companies can retaliate against them. So you really have a system where farmers are made serfs on their own land, essentially. You know, they own the land, they take on all the risk, they're the ones actually growing the chickens, yet at the end of the day, the company is the one calling all of the shots. And so throughout the hearings, you heard from a lot of these farmers, many of whom actually showed up to speak in spite of threats of retaliation that these companies had made. I mean, that's another thing that's really astounding about the situation. I mean, in 21st century America, you have independent citizens, many of these farmers are veterans. They flew in Vietnam, they were in the special forces. These farmers are now afraid to speak because these companies are threatening them. I mean, that's, you know, this is an economic issue, but it's also fundamentally a political issue. It's really amazing. And that's what we heard at the poultry hearing, and similar dynamics in cattle and in dairy and in hogs.
Now,
so that's really what officials heard.
Do we have a sense as to whether or not when a processor essentially says to their farmers, hey, you need to upgrade to this ventilation system made by this company. We want your dimensions of your chicken coops to be X instead of Y. Do we have a sense of what the impetus is behind those requirements? In other words, this processor has a relationship with the company that makes the ventilation system, and or this company basically has a strategic imperative to put these farmers into debt because it then weakens the farmers' negotiation position. Do we know how much of that is involved in this, or is it just pure speculation as to what, how that breaks down?
I mean, it's very hard to, you know, prove specific intent. I think at the end of the day, these companies are really just looking at their bottom line. You know, if placing farmers in a very precarious situation, then, you know, ups their bargaining power and lets them exploit them in a way that furthers their bottom line, sure, I think they're going to go ahead and do that, you know. I think, yeah, at the end of the day, the kind of equipment that they're mandating is generally just in the service of producing more chickens, or, you know, heavier chickens. And the farmers just end up being the casualty of those dictated terms.
So we don't really have a sense of whether or not that's sort of built into their strategy. Like, you know, we impose these requirements on there. Now, of course, they can impose these requirements on there because, of course, there's really no other options. Once the farmers have gone down the road, even somewhat, to build a farm for these chickens, to produce these chickens, then they're already basically on the hook.
Yeah, exactly. And many farmers at the hearings reported having to take out, you know, multiple mortgages. In some instances, farmers have actually lost their farm entirely because they haven't been able to keep up with their debt payments, in addition to, you know, lower and lower prices for their chickens. Poultry farmers are actually now paid under this payment system called the tournament system, which is a very opaque system that allows the company basically to weigh the birds behind closed doors and rank farmers in relation to one another and basically pay them whatever it decides. There's really no transparency, and unlike in an open competitive marketplace where, you know, every pound of chicken fetches the same price, in this it's really the company that can arbitrarily give whatever it wants.
Now, I mean, we should take a moment here also to just talk about, I mean, I saw some of this stuff documented. I think it was a movie, Food Inc., which covered a lot of this. And, you know, we're talking about here essentially subcontracted factory farms, right, where the idea is to just get as big a chickens as possible, some that, you know, can barely even beyond almost what chicken physics and physiology will allow for. A lot of these chickens get so fat they can't even support themselves on their own legs, and that's when we start to see the use of antibiotics, because then you've got chickens living in conditions that are not particularly friendly to being healthy. And this is all, I mean, on some level, this is all stems from this system that we've created. Is that it?
Yeah, I think that's partly it. I mean, you know, I think that the thing that should concern us the most is that we've basically surrendered our food system to a handful of companies. So, you know, whether in a competitive marketplace, if one company was making chickens that were, you know, grotesquely, you know, fed with all sorts of antibiotics, and it was producing chickens that were unhealthy or, you know, that were lower quality, we'd be able to go to another company. But now, because there are so few of them, it really undercuts consumer choice. And so I think the thing that should worry us primarily is that our food system is controlled by so few players.
So you had the Obama administration in 2010, anyways. It looks like the USDA had the capacity, without congressional approval, to change some of the rules, I guess, essentially, that would have allowed for more competition among processors and would have given farmers more independence. What happened?
A few things happened. One is that House Republicans and some Democrats really went out of the way to derail the process. So as you said, you know, they didn't really have any natural procedural role. But what they did was they held their own hearings that allowed big industry players, big trade association representatives, a platform to amplify a lot of propaganda about how these new reforms were going to lead to thousands of job losses, to, you know, more expensive meat, to less meat. So they really helped the industry build a huge campaign. In addition to that, what the House ended up doing is including in its appropriation bill a rider that defunded the rulemaking effort. So it basically deprived USDA of the ability to keep working on some of the more stringent rules that would have returned packers and stockyards to the more robust form that it was initially passed. So between these two things, the House really was able to derail a lot of the reform efforts.
So essentially, I mean, let me see if I've got this correct, that the USDA had the capacity to essentially write these rules without congressional approval because Congress sets up a statute that says the USDA can do X, Y, and Z, and this fell under that purview. But then what Congress did was literally create a an amendment to a overall budgetary bill that basically said we're going to defund the part of USDA that would be able to generate these rules. We're just not going to allow them to pay whatever, the lawyers or the photocopying costs or whatever it was, essentially, to do this. Is that do I have that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it was really stunning to see happen. And I think, you know, on the one hand, this was to be expected. You know, there have been moments in the past few decades when there's been, you know, serious reform on the table, and every time, you know, under the pressure of corporate lobbies, Congress has caved. I think what was significant this time is that it was the administration that was calling the fight. I mean, it was really signaling to these big companies that their game was up. So it called the fight, you know, it had these hearings, it opened up a lot of investigations, and yet when it actually came time to fight, it never showed up. I mean, I think, you know, Congress was played a role in derailing a lot of the reform, but the administration went totally silent. I mean, it has the bully pulpit to, you know, draw attention to issues, to shame members of Congress, and instead it just went totally silent, went in full retreat. And I think a lot of farmers and activists, and especially farmers who had gone out of their way to attend these hearings and oftentimes risk their livelihood, they feel totally abandoned. And it's really hard to understand, you know, what was at play other than, you know, some combination of political cowardice and ultimately moral oversight.
Do you think it would have been a different situation had the Democrats retained control of the House in 2010? I mean, I don't want to sound like an Obama administration apologist on this level, but it seems to me that they had basically run out of what they were willing to expend political capital on in this situation, and they had to expend more than they were willing to expend because of this flip of Congress.
Sure, I think that's one way to look at it. I mean, you know, again, it's hard to speculate. And as we know, you know, after the 2010 midterm elections, you know, it was the Daley era. The administration was really sent on being very compliant with big business.
The Bill Daley era you're talking about now. So where we had
the Bill Daley era, exactly. So
Morgan
we saw
Stanley,
a whole host of concessions.
Former
I mean, that
director.
Said, you know, this is not a ideological debate. You know, this is actually a perfect populist issue. You basically have big companies abusing independent farmers. I mean, it's ripe for Tea Party. You know, so if the administration had wanted to, it really could have spun this issue strategically in a way that could further its end. You know, it's not a question over how to fix the debt or address immigration reform. It's a lot simpler than that. And so I think, you know, for sure, you know, there were a whole host of issues on the table. The political environment had changed. But I think when there's a will, there's a way. And, you know, the fact that the administration went totally silent, I think, is inexcusable.
And so where are we now? I mean, is this something that doesn't get revisited for years and years and years to come? Because, you know, at one point, I think in your piece, you talk about having taken all of this testimony, having investigated, having put out reports saying that we have a problem with the lack of antitrust or the way that antitrust legislation is being, I guess, interpreted, both in terms of the way that it's been interpreted by successive administrations and since sort of reinterpreted by courts, and maybe in some respect as a function of that, and also the USDA in terms of the way that they execute the regulations, but having documented all this and then not being able to make the changes in some ways sets the whole thing back even further, doesn't it?
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly right. What the administration has done is not only failed to deliver this big promise, but it's implicitly condoned a lot of the abuse that we're seeing by companies. I mean, it's almost as if, you know, you have a, you know, sanitation official go to a restaurant to inspect the kitchen, and he gets there and he sees all sorts of, you know, unsanitary conditions. Employees aren't washing their hands. You know, there's dirt everywhere. There's mice. And the official documents this and walks away. And you expect some kind of retribution, you know, but in this instance, what's happened is that the official walked away and nothing happened. And so that basically tells the restaurant that it's able to just get away with what it's doing. And I think that's exactly the kind of dynamic that we've seen here. And so in some ways, as you just said, it's really set the farmers back.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and I appreciate your writing it and coming on and talking to us about it. Lena Khan, from the policy analyst from the Markets Enterprise Resiliency Initiative at the New America Foundation. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the better half of the program today. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've got my late-night smooth jazz voice going today. So things may get a little crazy in the better half of the program today. 646-257-3920 is the number. I will now fire up my IM machine. Tomorrow on the program, we are anticipating talking to Bill McKibben. Doing a lot of talk about the upcoming conference in Qatar. I don't know what's going to happen there, but in the wake of talking to the director and producer of Chasing Ice, we see new reports that the permafrost is melting at an even increasingly rapid rate. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute, folks. There's a reason why they used to call it the permafrost, as in permanent frost. But if it's melting, guess what? It's not permanent anymore. That's a problem. That's a serious problem. So we will talk to Bill McKibben on the program tomorrow. Again, folks, if you have the opportunity to become a member, your support is needed and appreciated. Other ways to support the show. Also, take our survey. I know a lot of non-members hanging out. Don't ever go to the website at majority.fm. Go there. Just click on we'll have the survey in our first post of the day. Click through there and take the survey. It'll take you 4 minutes, and it will be helpful to us. At the very least, it gives me something to look at night that isn't directly politics, so I can look at some other data set and it not be politics. Also, of course, if you have suggestions as to guests we should be interviewing, majorityreporters@gmail.com, majorityreporters@gmail.com. We're going to take a quick break and then head into the better half of the program, 646-257-3920. Conservatives, you are welcome to call in. I don't know if there are any more conservatives. Have they all just sort of like...
They just evaporated?
Yeah, I mean... There's always conservatives, but I mean, now we have like Republicans talking like, we've got to change our party.
We have to change our party as we complain about the people who we want to get to join us.
Right. And of course, none of that's happening on a state level. When we come back, we'll be talking about the supposed filibuster reform. And Walmart, in addition, essentially, to, they're claiming now it was a rogue supplier that had a factory in a Bangladesh factory where over 100, seen reports past even 112 workers died in a horrible fire. Recently. In addition to that, Walmart has now more bribery scandals. You remember the Mexico bribery scandals. These guys this seems to be their business practice. Because I don't know if anybody's been fired from it. I don't think so. I think you've got some people who've been promoted, but not fired. Also, this story, more evidence that the voting laws, which restricted people's right to vote in Florida, were set up specifically to restrict people's right to vote in Florida.
Surprise, surprise.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment.